I was 14 years old, and my general thinking was that when you want to earn money, it's not a fun thing, right? Well, you need to exchange your time for money. So when I heard about the conversation that you just could invest or give money and get more money back later on, well, that sounded really like something amazing to me, something that was almost unbelievable in the sense that, well, from that point in time, I probably became even more frugal in the sense that, well, every dollar you don't spend today, it's worth $10 in 40 years from now on. And that's when really, yeah, the game of compounding probably started for me.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Peter Sleggers, the founder of the world-famous and hugely successful Compounding Quality newsletter. Peter and I missed each other at last year's Berkshire meeting, but connected soon after. It was Gautam Bate, the author of The Joys of Compounding, who in Omaha told me I should chat with Peter. We had a few wonderful calls since then, and I met Peter in person at Guy Spier's ValueX in Clusters, soon after this recording. Peter's enthusiasm for investing is contagious, his appetite for knowledge inspiring, and his dedication to teaching admirable. Peter Sleggers studied financial management at the Catholic University of Leuven and graduated summa cum laude. He worked 3 years for a Belgian asset manager before focusing full-time on his investment newsletter, Compounding Quality. The newsletter has more than 350,000 followers across social media and more than 135,000 email subscribers. The goal of the newsletter is to help other investors by focusing on quality investing. His investment philosophy can be summarized as follows. Find great businesses led by outstanding managers that trade at fair valuation levels. Peter is joining us from Belgium, where I spent a year as an exchange student 2 decades ago, and where, at the time, I found Peter Lynch's book One Up on Wall Street at a tiny, charming English language bookstore. The same way Peter Lynch introduced me to investing, my today's guest inspires many readers, followers, and listeners to explore it as well. Please help me welcome Peter Sleggers. Well, hi, how are you? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Bogumil.
So we got to chat a few months ago, and time flies, and here we are chatting again, and I was really looking forward to this conversation. You're very passionate about investing, and you've been sharing quite a bit of research, data, interviews, knowledge, information about some very famous investors. And I think what you're doing, you help a lot of investors speed up their process in acquiring knowledge that you organized and made it so accessible. So I'll ask you a lot about that. I'm very curious. But before we get there, you might know that I'm always curious about the early days. So I want to ask you about your childhood upbringing and how you think that time influenced you, your relationship with money, and how that fired up this passion for investing.
For sure. So first of all, I want to say that it's very lovely to be here. And I want to sincerely thank you for the opportunity, Bogumil. So I really think that if everyone would invest in stocks, the world will be a healthier and wealthier place. And that's the thing I think you are trying to work on, and I am too. So helping other investors is really something that makes me jump out of bed every morning. So to be honest, when I talk about my childhood, I was raised in a quite frugal family, I guess. So this also means that I've always been money conscious. So even at the age of 7 years, 8 years, I was very frugal in some way and money conscious. And then when you talk about how the investment journey began, well, I've always been interested in stocks. I never liked to spend money. I saved as much money as I possibly could, and so on. So as a kid, I always used to do vacation work, like restocking store shelves, sorting candy on an assembly line, things like that. And while I have a lot of respect for people doing these kind of jobs, I never really liked it. To be completely honest with you, I absolutely detested it. And also, made me very afraid about, going to work after my studies. But things changed soon in the sense that when I was 14 years old, on a nice summer evening, my parents had some friends over at their house and someone was talking about the stock market. I never heard about that. And to me, that sounds like something amazing, right? So you could actually make money without having to work for it. And I thought that that was one of the most beautiful things I had ever heard. So it really sparked a light in me. And that day, my interest in the stock market was born. So the day after the conversation, I set up a brokerage account. I did that via my parents because I live in Belgium. And in Belgium, you are not allowed to own stocks under the age of 18. And after a few days, the account was open and I transferred all my money I earned that summer because of the vacation works to my brokerage account. But back then, there was only one problem. I didn't know anything about economy. I didn't know anything about stocks. So actually, I had no idea which stock I should try to buy. And quote unquote, luckily, the broker I used had a topic list and they recently added a new company to the list. It was a local company active in the production, storage of supply of oil and gas and so on. So what I thought is, the people who are managing the topic list, they were so-called experts. So I thought, they should know what they were doing, right? So I blindly followed them and bought a specific company with all the money I had earned that summer. So no diversification, no knowledge. I just bought the stock with all the money I earned. And then after 1 year, I sold the stock. And I sold the stock with a loss of 60%, so 60% after 1 year. And to me, that was actually the best investment I have ever made. So my worst investment ever has actually become my best investment ever. Why? Well, after selling the company, which was really painful for me, I could really beat myself up. I said to myself, how can I be so stupid? Investing is nothing for me. I just need to work hard, right? Like doing vacation work, doing vacation work and working in factories and stuff like that. And I think that when something like that happens to you, like in my case, making a terrible investment mistake, two things can happen to you. So the first thing you can do is, you indeed conclude that investing is not something for you and you give up. And a second option is, you promise yourself to never make the same investment mistake again and to educate yourself. And I decided to do the latter. So from the age of 15, I started reading a lot of investing and finance books. Every morning I read every financial newspaper I could find. I watched a lot of investing videos and economy videos on YouTube. Now, more recently, listening to podcasts like yours and so on. Fun thing to tell you maybe is that my ex-girlfriend, so my girlfriend back in the days, well, she told me that I love books and the stock market more than I loved her. And probably she was right because we broke up a few months later. But okay, I think for the people listening, well, what can you learn from this? I think that when you start making many investment mistakes at the beginning, it's one of the best things that can actually happen to you. So it makes sense. It's way better to make a mistake when you invest with $1,000 than when you invest with $100,000, for example. And it's almost certain that when you start investing, well, you will make a lot of mistakes. So failures are really a part of life. And if you've never failed, you've probably never tried anything new. And in that sense, the life of optimistic investors is beautiful. So if you make a good investment decision, you make money, which is good. And if you make a bad decision, well, you learn something new, which is also good. As Thomas Edison said, well, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that don't work. Maybe something small to add here is, yeah, I think regarding investing, but probably everything in life, it's very important to have great mentors in life. So the beautiful thing about the world we live in today is that you can learn from the best investors in the world via the internet and by reading books. As Charlie Munger said, and I believe we will talk more about Charlie Munger later, but as he said, well, there are answers worth billions of dollars in a $30 history book, and that's exactly the case. And that's a beautiful thing today, I guess.
I agree. I like the sound of that. Wow, you touched on so many things. Well, first of all, I'm very curious about that early stock conversation that you had. Mm-hmm. What's your recollection of it? What was it about and how did it come about, the early conversation that somebody had in your family household when somebody stopped by and talked about stocks? How do you remember that conversation?
So back in the days, well, I was 14 years old and my general thinking was that when you want to earn money, it's not a fun thing, right? Well, you need to exchange your time for money. So when I heard about the conversation that you just could invest or give money and get more money back later on, well, that sounded really like something amazing to me, something that was almost unbelievable in the sense that, well, from that point in time, I probably became even more frugal in the sense that, well, every dollar you don't spend today, it's worth $10 mm-hmm. in 40 years from now on. And that's when really, yeah, the game of compounding probably started for me. And it's the game of compounding and investing, but also in knowledge by reading books, health, because I like sport a lot, and stuff like that. And I'm really grateful for that friend of my parents, because at my parents, they were really conservative in the sense that, well, don't invest in stocks. It's too risky. You can lose your money. You hear the stories of people who lost 60, 70% during the dot-com bubble, things like that. But I think that if you have a clear investment philosophy and you educate yourself, and you don't gamble, so invest, don't speculate, that everyone can invest in stocks and become successful on the stock market.
I grew to appreciate how that one book, one conversation, one interaction can be life-changing. And it's not just investing, I think, in many careers. So whenever people reach out to me, I have even the shortest conversations with them because I feel like I never know what kind of a massive impact this one mm-hmm. conversation can have. So I'm very grateful that there was somebody that crossed your path early on in your life that sets you in that direction. And I like the theme that you mentioned of appreciating those dollars or euros that you had to earn and save. And I wrote an article about precious dollars because the money that gets invested, it's the money that was on a whole long journey from getting earned to getting taxed to all the expenses you had to have. You had to say no to a lot of, at 14, 15, probably candy and a trip to the movies. And then finally, there's still something left. It's a very precious euro or dollar that's left that you get to invest. So I like that. And you mentioned something, how everybody should be an investor. I give a TED talk about it, how I think there's a great investor in all of us if you look at it the right way. And there's something about the ownership of businesses. I'm still, you know, years, two decades into my professional career, I still think of the fact that I get to own small pieces of some incredible businesses out there and be treated just like the founder and the leading shareholders as a sometimes small minority shareholder in my own name or in my client's name. There's something really powerful about it. I get to, in a sense, piggyback or become a, you know, a sidecar participant in the success of the business. Somehow it still truly speaks to me, and I find it very alluring. You mentioned Charlie Munger, and Charlie Munger, especially in the last few interviews he gave, he talks about teaching. And I got to ask Charlie and Warren a question during the last Omaha meeting, and I brought up Ben Graham, and Charlie picked up on it, and he said how Graham wanted to teach, he wanted to pass it on. And you went through this transition. You say how you're a former investment professional, and now you're teaching, you're spreading the the message. Tell me more about this experience of teaching others and helping them on their journey.
It's quite funny that you phrase it that way, because once I graduated from university, I started working for a Belgian asset management company involved in managing an equity fund. But to be honest, just when I joined the industry, I was really skeptical against the industry as a whole, just because of what you read and heard from people like Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and so on. So as you also know, about 85% of all professional investors don't outperform the market. There are also a lot of commercial incentives, so switching from value to growth, from growth to quality, things like that. Professionals or the industry, Wall Street, they make a lot of decisions to fill their own pockets at the cost of their clients. There are a lot of hot sectors that invest in because it sells really well from a commercial perspective. But those kind of companies are usually really bad investments. And I only wanted to do what I genuinely believe is the right thing to do and to help other people. And to be honest, and that's why I think it's so funny that you talk or you mentioned teaching. When I was a child, I always wanted to become a teacher. And also when I needed to make a choice at the university, I even thought to become between doing something to become a teacher or to follow my passion for finance and investing. And I chose the latter. So I did a study in finance. But this still meant that I wanted to help other investors. And back in the days, so a few years ago, I also loved to tweet about investment concepts and general investment related things under my real name, under my personal name. But then my employer came to me and he said, well, you aren't allowed to do that anymore. Just tweet about the fund you manage and the philosophy of the company you work for, right? And I had some ethical problems with that. I also always wanted to go and work for myself. And that's basically why I created Compounding Quality in the first place. Just for fun, to help other people a bit, to share investment insights from Buffett, from Munger, from Terry Smith, people like that. I would have never dared to dream, I guess, that I could make a job out of this. But since September, I'm doing this full time. And to me, that's really combining the best of both worlds. So on the one hand, you are teaching, you are helping other people, you are conceptualizing everything. And on the other hand, you're still following the stock market 24/7. So that's really, a lovely thing. And now I can do what I genuinely believe is the right thing to do. So also, for example, I think integrity and honesty is very important. That's also why I said, well, I have a portfolio at Compounding Quality. All my investable assets will be invested in the portfolio. Why? Well, skin in the game. If you do well, I do well, and the other way around. I think that's really, really important. And maybe to add here, I think also my story about how I got to quality investing is quite funny. So we already talked about the fact that, I was involved in managing an equity fund. But before I joined the industry, so when I was still a student, I considered myself as a pure value investor. So trying to buy really cheap stocks based on the PE multiple, the price to book multiple. So really the deep value cigarette butt investing like Warren Buffett in the early days and then Graham in his time, right? But there was one problem. So when I joined the industry, when I joined the company I went working for, I suffered from a lot of home biases. So basically this also meant that I needed to sell my entire portfolio and rethink my entire investment philosophy. That's when I started reading books like Quality Investing from Lawrence Cunningham, How to Pick Quality Shares from Phil Oakley, Only the Best Will Do, Investing for Growth from Terry Smith, and so on. And for me, that immediately clicked. Something also very important, I think, is that Warren Buffett, many people see him as a value investor, but I actually see him as a quality investor. And I even see him as one of the first quality investors ever. So it's true,
it's true
that in the beginning of his career, well, he focused on cigarette butts, so really cheaply valued stocks, inspired by Benjamin Graham. But Buffett actually started focusing on buying wonderful companies at a fair price rather than fair companies at a wonderful price way sooner than most people think. So in his annual letter of 1972, Warren already focused on metrics such as the return on equity, the return on tangible assets, and so on. And in that letter, in the letter of 1972, well, he said that he wanted to invest in companies when two criteria are met. So one, the average return on equity over the past 10 years should be larger than 20%. And two, there should be no single year over the past decade where the return on equity was lower than 10%. So those are the kind of criteria quality investors are looking for, right? And it's also no coincidence that 1972 was the year that Berkshire Hathaway bought See's Candies. So See's Candies is seen a bit as the first quality investor ever of Berkshire Hathaway. So what you can conclude here is that under the influence of Charlie Munger, of course, well, Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway evolved to quality investing. And they have been doing this since 1972. So that's more than 50 years that they are focused on buying wonderful businesses at a fair price.
You picked up on something interesting. We're talking about teaching, but I'm thinking the other side of it is learning. And I think the key as an investor and seeing it as a lifelong pursuit is that you will continue to learn. And we say how Munger was a learning machine and he talked about himself as a, you know, walking book. There was always a book in his hand. And I think the secret here is that the world will continue to change and evolve. And so should you as an investor, right? Certain principles will stay the same. And speaking of principles, I want us to go on a quick journey. If you had a chance to go back to your 14, 15 year old self for, you know, 3 minutes and out of context, you could just share with that younger self a couple of timeless principles, the one evergreen ones that you think of, given the studies, the research you've done, the letters that you read, the books that you consumed, what would be a handful of principles that you could pass on to your younger self? I'm thinking of younger audience listening or people that are new to investing. What are some of the principles that you think were the most helpful, timeless ones?
I think that's a very important point. Also, when we talk about value investing, growth investing, things like that, well, in the end, all investing is value investing, right? So you try to buy stocks for less than what they are worth. And it's completely naive, I think, to think that over 20 years from now, 30 years from now, your investment philosophy and approach will be exactly the same as it is today. Because as you state, Bogomil, the world is continuously changing and things like that. So you always need to keep evolving and keep learning. Now, obviously, also, since you were 18 years old, I've made plenty of mistakes. I think it's necessary. It's good because it helps you to not make them again, right? But yeah, I think the most important thing for me probably would be most important advice to cut out the noise. in the sense that there's so much news today. And when the stock market goes 2% down or 3% down, well, some people feel frightened, especially in the beginning. But when you just look at the long-term picture and look, for example, at a chart of the Dow Jones over the past 200 years or something like that, well, it just looks like a straight line, basically. So I think it's one, yeah, focus on the long term. And then two, I think stock price fluctuations don't matter too much. So when you look at stocks, you see that the average difference between the 52-week high and low is on average 50%. But this doesn't mean that the stock became 50% more worth more or worth less just because of the stock price. I think that you should always focus on the evolution of the intrinsic value per share growth instead of the stock price. And it helps you to stay sane and to take advantage of Mr. Market.
I like the sound of that. What I'm hearing is cut out the noise, focus on the ownership of the businesses you're buying, and don't pay as much attention to the daily price. And if you do pay attention, do it so that you can buy things at a lower price. And I like the point that you're making, and I recommend it to a lot of people to look at the price range of the stock that they want to buy over the last at least 52 weeks. I think a lot of people are surprised to see that the business that they think everybody knows about, and they just found out that it's such a great business, that it actually trades at a pretty wide range. And I was always curious, what would it take for me to buy it at the low end of that range? So that was the value bias that I have. But I think of it as you mentioned, Buffett, how already in 1972, he was becoming more of a quality investor. For me, it's being a value buyer. I do want to get a bargain. I do want to get a deal. But then being a growth holder, once you find a business that's worth holding, let it run. I write about an infinite investment horizon. I manage money for families, individuals that have a very long investment horizon. Usually either they want to see this money grow over their lifetime or they want to leave it for the next generation or a few generations. And it's a very open-ended game that we assume here and we play. But I also realize that the assets we invest in the businesses, they're finite. There's no business that will last forever. They, even if they're still around, they might not be as glorious as they used to be. I'm thinking of U.S. Steel. That was the first billion-dollar company 100-some years ago, and it's only a few billion dollars today. It's still around, but it wouldn't be a good place to even preserve your purchasing power, right? So that's what I think of. Just because it's still around, maybe there are other places. So I think this ongoing change will make us maybe move around from an asset to an asset. And I'm thinking of Buffett. He realized very quickly that the textile business that Berkshire was in was not the place for the capital in the long run. And I had Jacob McDonough on the show, who you might know, who wrote a wonderful book about those early days of Berkshire Hathaway, how it was moving away from textiles to being a holder of all those other businesses. You brought up the term quality and quality businesses. Tell me more what it means and how do we fish out those companies out of the big, big sea of thousands of publicly traded companies?
Yeah. Maybe one small thing to add first on what you said, Bogomil. I think what helps me a lot, and I know that Warren Buffett does it and Monish Prabhai does it too, is to, when you invest in a company, you are an owner, right? So you own a part of the business. And every time you buy a stock, just to write down, let's take Apple as an example. If you are willing to buy one share, you need to be willing to buy the entire business, basically. So, for example, right, for Apple, you just look at the total market cap, which is $3 trillion right now. And what you can state there, or what you can write down is, well, I am buying Apple today. I'm buying the company for $3 trillion. And I think it's worth more than $3 trillion because reason X, Y, and Z. And that's something that can be really helpful and to help to also think and act as an investor. Now, when we are going to talk about quality investing or what quality investing is, to put in one sentence, or at least for me, well, quality investing to me is all about investing in the best companies in the world. That's how I would summarize it in one sentence. Now, how can you do this? Well, I use a three-step approach, and it's based on Warren Buffett on the one hand and Terry Smith, the quality investor Terry Smith from Fundsmith on the other hand. Three-step approach. So one, you try to buy wonderful companies. Two, you try to buy these wonderful companies led by outstanding managers. And then third point, well, you try to find those companies trading at fair valuation levels. So to quote Buffett here, well, indeed, it's far better to buy a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price. And if you ask me, that's where what quality investing is all about. And that's also a completely different approach compared to, for example, value investing, because when you invest in value stocks, you buy the stock when it looks cheap on fundamental criteria, and you sell the stock again when the undervaluation has disappeared. So once this happens, you sell the stock and you try to find another undervalued stock. And you do this again and again and again. And so from that point of view, value investors need to trade way more than quality investors do. So I think that quality investing is one of the only investment methods where you can really use a buy and hold approach. Because when you found one and you did your homework correctly, well, the company will continue to grow its intrinsic value per share growth at attractive rates. And you never need to sell the stock, basically, unless you made a mistake or the company is losing its moat. So that's what I like about quality investing so much. Now, in general, when you need to put it down, I think there are six essential characteristics of quality stocks. So the first one is that the company should have a competitive advantage or a moat. So they are doing something unique compared to its rivals. Second point is they have skin in the game. So the managers, it's a business that's still founder-led. There's a high insider ownership, things like that. Third point, low capital intensity. So they don't need a lot of capital to operate. Great capital allocation skills is the fourth point. So they put the money of shareholders to work at attractive rates of returns. They also are very profitable. So they translate most revenue into profit. And they also translate most profit into free cash flow. And then last but not least, you have the secular trend. So you want to invest in companies that are able to grow at attractive rates of return. So for me, this is really important. If that's okay for you, Bogomil, we can go over all the six characteristics for a while. And if not, yeah, feel free to ask a question about this concept.
Let's do it.
Okay, perfect, perfect. So six characteristics. So the first one is the moat or the competitive advantage. So you really want to invest in companies that do something unique. So where it's really hard for competitors to enter the market. So as a quality investor, or when you try to use a quality investment philosophy, you never will invest in a company when a company doesn't have a competitive advantage. So you never will invest in the next big thing, but instead you want to invest in companies that have already won. So a company that was a market leader 10 years ago, that is a market leader today, and where you think that they will continue to be the market leader in 10 years from now. Now, Warren Buffett also defined this in his circle of competence. So he said that a company is within a circle of competence when two criteria are met. So one, he understands how the business makes money. And two, he is able to make an educated guess about how the company, but also how the industry will look like in 10 years from now. And for example, it's quite clear that in 10 years from now, everyone will still be drinking Coke. Everyone will still be brushing their teeth, things like that. But then on the other side, when you talk about artificial intelligence, for example, or cybersecurity, that's way harder to make an educated guess about because the industry is evolving so rapidly. And staying within your circle of competence is really important. Therefore, I'm not going to say that you shouldn't invest in cybersecurity or in AI, but yeah, you should do your homework there to be able to make an educated guess. What I am personally trying to do is I'm trying to quantify everything so I can, for example, enter the criteria in a stock screener and things like that. When you talk about the moat, well, I always use two criteria, and that is one, the gross margin is larger than 40%, and two, the return on invested capital is larger than 15%. And when this is the case, and the gross margin and the return on invested capital are very stable, you know that you found a company that has a that has pricing power as well as a competitive advantage. By the way, when we talk, for example, about Morningstar's wide moat index, so they made an index based solely of companies who have a sustainable competitive advantage, you see that on average, so since 2000, these companies are performed by a bit over 4% since 2000. And as you know, well, most investors don't outperform the market. And when you are able to do, when you are able to perform better than the market, you are already doing exceptionally well. And when you can compound with four extra percentage points per year over long periods of times, well, then amazing things will happen to you as an investor. So that's also what you're trying to do here with the criteria and the characteristics. So when you talk about the moat, well, a company can basically have a moat on based on five characteristics of five different moat sources. It can be based on intangible assets, switching costs, network effects, cost advantages, and efficient scale. So to briefly touch upon it, well, intangible assets. So that's when a company has a competitive advantage based on a very strong brand name, intellectual property, stuff like that. I think a great example is Coca-Cola, for example. So Warren Buffett once said, well, if you gave me $100 billion and said, take away the market leadership of Coca-Cola, I would give it back to you and say to you, well, it can be done. So that's a great example of a moat based on tangible assets, right? The second moat source a company can have is one based on switching costs. So when it costs the customer money to switch to another product. But it's important to highlight here that the switching costs can also be time or psychology based. Take Apple, for example. They have very loyal clients. Why? Well, their products are great, of course, but also your MacBook, your iPhone, your iPad, they are all interlinked. And when you, for example, want to switch from your MacBook to a laptop running on a Microsoft environment, well, then it takes some time to learn the interface of Microsoft. It's working differently than a MacBook computer. Well, that's an example of a switching cost based on effort-based switching cost, basically. The third mode source you can have is one based on network effects. And this is by far the strongest moat source. This has also been proven by academic research that companies that have a competitive advantage based on networks effects tend to perform the best in the long term. So network effects are when a company's products or services become more valuable when more people use it. The best example is probably Meta platforms or Facebook. Probably almost everyone who's listening to this podcast right now will already have used Facebook or Instagram or WhatsApp today. So Meta Platforms has 3.6 billion monthly active users, I guess, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make a lot of sense when you're using WhatsApp to download another messaging app on your phone, because everyone is using WhatsApp and having two. Yeah, it's just annoying, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's a really strong moat based on network effects. Another example here may be Visa and MasterCard. So the more vendors use the payment network of Visa and MasterCard, the more valuable it becomes and the more people will use it. So when you talk about the payment network space, well, it will be almost impossible for other companies to take up the moat of Visa and MasterCard. So that was the third mode source, network effects. Fourth one, cost advantages. This is the weakest one, and I'm personally not a big fan of this one. Again, academic research has proven that modes based on cost advantages are the weakest one. So they perform the least well in the long term. So think about companies like Ryanair or Kia, for example. And then last but not least, you can also have a mode based on efficient scale. So for example, when there's only room for one or a few players in the industry, think about S&P Global and Moody's, for example. Those companies are usually also beautiful businesses because they have a lot of pricing power, high margin, great capital allocation skills, and so on. So I think that's really the essence of the moat or the competitive advantage. Really important. And I think the takeaway here is, yeah, quality investors try to invest only in companies with a competitive advantage. And when you just would make a bucket of companies who have a moat, and you can do that by looking at the gross margin larger than 40% and the return on invested capital larger than 15%. Well, these kind of companies on the long term, on average, tend to perform better than the indices. So that's the moat part. The second part is a skin in the game. Also something really important. So skin in the game is, yeah, you want that the incentives of management are aligned with the ones of you as a shareholder. And you see in reality that this isn't the case for many companies. So for example, managers or management can have a lot of personal agendas because, for example, their bonus or their salary is based on the sales of the company, which is why they acquire a large company, which destroys shareholder value and things like that. So Warren Buffett basically said, well, invest in companies who are led by managers who love what they do. So who don't do it for the money, but just because like the business is their baby and they want to create a lot of shareholder value. Something really important, something that's really underestimated. I'm giving a lot of Charlie and Warren quotes here, but to talk about Charlie, well, I've always, yeah, what I'm paraphrasing Charlie Munger here, but he said, well, I know how important incentives are, but I always underestimated them. So incentives are really, really important. It's also why, for example, at Compound Equality, 60 to 70% of the portfolio is invested in companies that are still led by their founder, for example. So how are you going to quantify this? Well, you want to invest on the one hand in founder-led businesses, so where the founder is still active in the business, or on the other hand, where insider ownership is larger than 10%. And when this is the case, well, you dramatically increase your chances that the incentives of management are aligned with the ones of you as a shareholder. This, again, also has academically been proven. So, for example, you have the Credit Suisse Family 1000 study, which concludes that family-led businesses outperform on average by 3.7% per year. And the same goes by founder-led companies. So you have a book called The Founder's Mentality. And that book basically states that, well, founder-led businesses outperform by 4% per year on average. So you see here, we talk about the moat. Well, companies with a moat outperform on average in the long term. The same goes for companies with skin in the game. So what we are trying to do here is for each step, for each characteristics, we are combining criteria that on average tend to do quite well. And by combining those, you are trying to build an investable universe, which on average, I hope will do well. And based on that universe, you are trying to build your portfolio. So we talked about the moat. We talked about the skin in the game part. I think third part, or third characteristic is the low capital intensity. So the less capital a company needs to operate, the better. And once again, when you would just out of the S&P 500, for example, create a bucket with companies that require or don't require a lot of capital to operate, versus companies that require a lot of capital to operate, you will see that the companies that are not capital intensive tend to do better on the stock market. Now, how are you going to quantify this? How can you enter this in a stock screener, for example? Well, you can look at CapEx or capital expenditures on sales less than 5% or CapEx on operating cash flow less than 25%. And for example, well, yesterday I looked at the metrics for the portfolio. For example, for the portfolio of compounding quality, CapEx sales is now equal to 4.2% versus 19% for the S&P 500. So by looking at this, well, you see indeed that the capital intensity is low, and that's what you try to achieve here. Now we have arrived at the fourth point, and that's capital allocation. And capital allocation is something really important. I even think that together with the moat, it's probably the most important thing for investors, or at least for quality investors. And capital allocation is also the most important task of management. And it's a decision about what the company will do with the money it earns. So for example, McDonald's makes money from selling hamburgers. Apple makes money from selling iPhones and MacBooks and things like that. And then the step afterwards for management is, okay, how are we going to put this capital to work? And it's the moral duty they have towards shareholders to put that capital to work at the most attractive rates of return. And in general, a company has four capital allocation options. So the first thing they can do is to invest in themselves, invest in organic growth. That's the most preferred capital allocation choice, especially when a company has a high return on invested capital. Second option they have is to pay down debt. So it can make a lot of sense when they have a leveraged balance sheet, when they just acquired another company and they want to deleverage, because a healthy balance sheet can give a company a lot of flexibility. Third option they have is M&A. But we already briefly touched upon this. Well, around 70% of M&A destroys value. And it's most of the time because of commercial incentives and the personal agenda of management. So they acquire another large company because then the merged company is larger. It's more prestige for them. They get a larger salary, a larger bonus, things like that. But that's really not what you want. You want that the management puts the creation of shareholder value first. So by the way, I think regarding this topic, William Thorndike's book, The Outsiders, is an excellent read. So in general, I'm quite skeptical about M&A. And when you are looking at M&A, I would advise people to look at serial acquirers. So companies with a decentralized business model who have acquired a lot of other businesses very successfully in the past. Think about Constellation Software from Mark Leonard, Brown & Brown, so an American insurance company, Watsco, an American HVAC company, Kelly Partners Group, so an Australian company who is building or trying to build some kind of constellation-alike system in the accounting industry, Technion, and so on. So those are the first three options they have. Invest in organic growth, pay down debt, M&A. And then the fourth option they have is to distribute it to shareholders via dividends or share buybacks. Now, how are you going to quantify this one? Well, you are looking for a return on invested capital larger than 15% and a return on capital employed larger than 20%. And once again, and it's a study from Goldman Sachs, when you just look at the companies with the highest and most stable return on invested capital, well, these companies tend to do really well on average on the stock market in the long term. And once again, I'm also giving a quote of Charlie Munger here. Well, what he said once is, over the long term, it's really hard for a stock to earn a much better return than a business which underlies it earns. So if the business earns a 6% return on capital over 40 years and you hold it for that 40 years, you're not going to make much different than a 6% return, even if you originally buy it at a huge discount. Conversely, or the other way around, well, if a business earns 18% on capital over 20 or 30 years, well, even if you pay an expensive-looking price, you'll end up with one hell of a result. So here, Charlie basically says that one of the main factors for stock price performance is the return on capital. Maybe one small side note to make here is that this is only true when the company has plenty of reinvestment opportunities. So when a company has a very high return on invested capital, but can't reinvest anything in the business? Well, in that case, the return on invested capital doesn't have any value at all. But I think the key takeaway here is that the return on invested capital is a really important metric. Now we have arrived at the fifth characteristic of a quality company, and that's the high profitability. Why is this so important? Well, I think it's quite straightforward. The higher the profitability, the better. So you want to invest in companies that translate most revenue into earnings, and also in companies that translate most earnings into free cash flow. How are you going to measure this, or how do I do it in a stock screener, for example? Well, gross margin larger than 40% and a profit margin larger than 10%. So a profit margin of 10% means that for every $100 in sales, the company makes $10 in profit. But what's maybe even more important here is that the company translates most earnings into free cash flow. And I took this snippet from the book Stocks from the Long Run from Jeremy Siegel. And in his book, he mentions a study from Sloan. And the study concludes that the companies that translate the most earnings into free cash flow outperform the companies that don't by 18% per year. So 1/8%. That's an amazing difference. And it shows you the importance of free cash flow. And I think why you should always prefer free cash flow over earnings. Why? Well, earnings are way easier, for example, to manipulate by management. They can be way more volatile and stuff like that. So also when a company translates or doesn't translate a lot of earnings into free cash flow, it can also be an indication that the company is doing accounting fraud and things like that. So free cash flow is really an important metric. And then we've arrived at the last point, and that's the secular trend or the attractive growth rate. Well, why is this so important? Because in the long term, stocks always tend to follow the evolution of the intrinsic value per share growth. And when you know that the evolution of the intrinsic value per share growth is mainly driven by the free cash flow per share growth, well, in that case, I think it makes a lot of sense that when a company is active in a secular trend or a strongly growing end market, well, in that case, it's way easier for them to grow at attractive rates as well and to grow their intrinsic value as well. What are some examples of secular trends? Well, for example, obesity, urbanizations, digital payments, or also cybersecurity is an example of a secular trend. How can you quantify this? Well, you're looking for revenue growth larger than 5% and also earnings growth larger than 7%. So you want this to be true in the past, so where the company managed to grow at these rates in the past, but also in the future. So where you estimate that the company can continue to grow at these rates in the years to come. So I think that's about it. So quality investing is all about buying wonderful companies at a fair price. And there are six characteristics of quality stocks. So one is the competitive advantage or the moat. You want to invest in companies that do something unique. Two, skin in the game. So where the incentives of management are aligned with the ones of you as a shareholder. Three, a low capital intensity. So they don't require a lot of capital to grow. Four, great capital allocation skills. So they put the money of shareholders to work at attractive rates of returns. Five, high profitability. So the higher the profitability, the better. And as last but not least, you want those companies to be able to grow at attractive rates. I think to me, that's those are the basics of what the investment philosophy or my investment philosophy is built on.
So I wrote down a couple of things, but what stood out to me is in the search for a quality business, it's a bit of a dance between something lasting and something worth the wait. So there are a lot of businesses that might be still around 20 years from now, but they're not worth the wait. And I wrote an article about a stock for a grandchild, and I kind of extrapolated this idea. What if you build a whole portfolio for somebody that can wait 20 years? And it's either a child, a grandchild, or nephew, or niece, a gift for somebody, mm-hmm. and once they're an adult that you get to use this capital, the next generation, and it could be your future self. If you had a liquidity event at some point in your life and you want to put some money away for 20 years and have a something as close to permanent capital as you can possibly imagine, if we can entertain it for a minute. So you start to think of businesses that deserve, and I want to emphasize the word deserve, the 20-year wait, right? So not only that they will be still around in the same name or brand, but they will use those 20 years. And all the things that you mentioned, it's giving this company a chance to use those 20 years to become bigger, better at what they do. The other thing that I wrote down that really stood out to me, and I talked about it with Christian Billinger that you might have heard of, is something that comes up in many conversations, you know, soul in the game, however you want to look at it. But I would call it something that we're looking for, something that's not for sale. We're looking for somebody that has such an immense passion to drive this business to new highs, that somebody that's no longer driven by traditional incentives, stock-based compensations, options, or turning their net worth from hundreds of millions to billions. That's not what's really driving them. You want to have the top of the company in the hands of people that are so passionate about what this business could be that they will work even if they're not paid to do it. And Munger and Buffett had a gift for finding businesses that do just that, with managements that operate this way, that even when they bought almost the entire company, these folks still showed up and did their best, although it was not financially driven. And it's an incredibly rare find. It's very counterintuitive, because in finance, in money, we feel like, you know, everything has a price. But what's the most valuable in terms of, you know, whether it's a brand, but also the people running it, it's what's really not for sale. You can't fake it. And I think that's a really powerful revelation for me, you know, being in the business for a while. You mentioned the founder and the family. It's fascinating when you look at businesses that have a long-term success rate and they've been around for a long time. There's usually an individual or a family behind it, and they take a long-term view. And they might be publicly traded, but they kind of operate as if they were privately held. So they don't really respond to the pressure of delivering earnings per share to a penny every quarter. And there's a handful of companies that, you know, even the way they communicate, you can tell that they're taking a very long-term view. But these are rare finds. But once you do find them, I think it's worth paying attention. I want to ask you about a handful of investors, maybe one or two, that obviously we talked about Buffett, Munger, but maybe some of them are lesser known that really stood out to you, and you also profile them in your newsletter. Is there anybody you want to mention? If I can pick up a name or two as well if you want me to, but is there anybody that the audience might be less familiar with? Maybe they heard the name, but you also profiled, and there might be a lesson or two worth sharing in this conversation.
Yeah, I think someone I really admire and who not everyone might may know is Francois Rochon. So he's a quality investor living in Canada, managing Giverny Capital. So we founded it in 1993. And since 1993, well, he actually returned 5,000% to shareholders. So this means he compounded at 14.4% per year over the past 30 years. I also interviewed him 1 month ago for the website. And I think he has three beautiful concepts that I want to highlight, and which I'm personally trying to use too. And it's about owner's earnings, his major mistakes, and his rule of three, his rule of three, which is truly amazing. So to start with the owner's earnings, I think in theory, and this is something really important to understand, in theory, it's really easy to calculate your return as an investor. So your return on an investor is always equal to the earnings growth of a company plus the shareholder yield plus the multiple expansion when you think the company will become more expensively valued in the future, or minus the multiple compression when you think that the company is a bit overvalued today in terms of a PE or a free cash flow yield. And in this formula, the shareholder yield is equal to the dividend yield plus the buyback yield. I'll repeat the formula once more because it's really important. your return on as an investor is always equal to the company's earnings growth plus the shareholder yield plus the multiple expansion or minus the multiple contraction. I can imagine that for some people, this might still sound a bit odd, or it's difficult to see the reality of the formula here. So the owner's earnings is something that's really important, also something really straightforward. And that's also, for example, I don't look at the yearly stock prices of the portfolio. The only thing I do is I look at the evolution of the owner's earnings of the companies I own. When, for example, in a year, the stock prices or your portfolio goes down 10%, but your owner's earnings, the average owner's earnings within your portfolio go up 8%, well, that's a really good sign because your company's performed really well and you are able to buy them at cheaper prices compared to 1 year ago. So what I'm trying to achieve is to invest in companies that can grow their owner's earnings by at least 10%. And I think it's a great way to look at the evolution of the intrinsic value and also to cut out the noise of the fluctuations of the stock price. So the owner's earnings is, like Monish Prabhai said, right? I'm a shameless copycat. It's something I quote-unquote stole from François Rochot, and François Rochot stole it on his turn from Warren Buffett. And that's how we all learn from each other. And I think it's a beautiful thing. Second thing, I think François Rochot is doing exceptionally well is that in each shareholder letter, he talks about his major mistakes. So again, François Rochot based this on Warren Buffett, because in one of his shareholder letters, Warren Buffett talked about his mistake du jour. So what François said to me in the interview, or when I interviewed him, is, well, if even Warren Buffett can recognize his mistakes, I certainly can too. And it's really important to, especially in the investment world, to be humble and honest against yourself and also against your shareholders or your partners. So admitting your mistakes keeps you humble. It allows you to learn from them. And it's very important when investing. Also, when you talk about François Rochot, well, something very important to highlight, and I think it's the case for most investors, the most costly mistakes have always been errors of omission. So the stocks that you didn't buy. So François talked about, for example, in 1994, he refused to buy Starbucks because he thought it was overvalued, 40 times earnings. 40 times earnings is really expensive, right? But if he would have bought it in 1994, well, the stock would be up 12,800%. So that's a 100 bagger. And I think it's just a beautiful concept that in every shareholder letter, he talks about his three biggest mistakes of the year. It helps you to stay humble, to put your mistakes into context and to learn from that. And that's something really important. And then the last thing that I think is that François is doing exceptionally well is he's always talking about his rule of three. And his rule of three states that one year out of three, the stock market will go down at least 10%. Two, 1 year or one stock out of three we buy will be a disappointment. And then three, 1 year out of three, we will outperform the index. I think this is so simple and so true. So having these rules in place really helps you to be better prepared when you face these obstacles, when your portfolio underperforms, when the market is doing badly, when a stock you buy is a disappointment, and so on. And it's really important that you mentally prepare yourself for these tough times because they happen to every investor, and having these rules in place will help you to stay sane and stay rational when this happens to you.
I like the focus on mistakes. You know, I like the idea that it would be best to learn from other people's mistakes. That's why reading other people's letters, history books, the books that you mentioned, it's just to see what else other people have done and what has not worked for them. I think that's the cheapest way to learn. I also noticed that if you make a mistake, somehow it sticks better. And you mentioned how your early investment, early in this conversation, how it didn't work out for you. And it didn't work out for me. I remember my early investment and it didn't work out for me. But I feel like it was a priceless lesson. I do meet people who join the market when things are easy or seemingly easy and the market is rising and it looks like everybody's a genius. I think it's a tricky time to join. You have to be very cautious about it because you might draw the wrong conclusions about what's happening. So I think you have to remember that it's a very humbling experience, as you said, and remind yourself that it will not always work out the way you want. Now, I prepare myself for it and maybe I hedge myself in some way because I think of it as me trying to be the least wrong. It's not that I have to be right all the time. I want to be the least wrong. What is it that I can do to be the least wrong? And the long game of investing is about survival. So you still have capital to invest through the ups and downs of it all. So that you don't ever have to start from scratch again. Munger had a saying about, he never wants to be in square one with nothing. It's the hardest thing to save that initial capital. So any risks that you take, think of what you can do to avoid losing it all. And then if it still makes sense, then you can focus on the upside. But I like the rules that you mentioned. I wrote down errors of omission and commission. I think it came up in this conversation quite a few times how, in the sense that there will be a lot of ideas that we will pass on. And then there will be the ones that we bought and we wish we didn't buy. I think being kind to yourself in the process, I think it's pretty important to as well. Write down those mistakes. Maybe share them if you want to. Look at them again. Don't beat yourself up too much. It's not that all of them will work out. I think that's important to know. And I think you mentioned it's a mental game. The key is to stay in the game, right? So if you live a life of regrets of all those stocks you wish you bought, I think you might be missing out what's right in front of you today and maybe focus on that a little bit as well. I think that's helpful. That has helped me. I want to ask you about your definition of success. I mean, you've already had multiple careers here. You were running a fund. Now you're teaching and spreading the message and writing some incredible content and sharing lessons of other investors. How do you think of success today, long term? How do you know you're on the right track? How do you think about it?
Yeah, I think my definition of success is just to lead a happy life, basically. So I don't think that success is about maximizing how much money you make or about maximizing your return in the investment world. It's just about doing something you love and helping other people along the way. So Charlie once said that happiness is reality minus expectations. And I think that's exactly true. So for me personally, what makes me happy is just trying to make progress every single day, try to learn new things, become a bit smarter every single day, and just to become the best version of yourself. So in life, everything compounds, wealth compounds, I think health compounds, knowledge compounds, happiness compounds. And yeah, I wish all listeners of the podcast just all the success and the happiness in the world. And yeah, I would be really honored to meet some of your listeners in the future via social media, via email, or even better, in real life.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host, an employee and partner of a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.